A remote atoll within the Papahanaumokuʻi Cay and Marine National Monument is home to an extraordinary collection of seabirds, more than 3 million, converging on a tiny space, some 1,500 acres. It's the only nesting ground for two seabird species that face an imminent threat from an unlikely source: invasive house mice that attack and kill nesting black-footed albatross and Laysan albatross. We spoke with Matt Brown, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Superintendent for Papahanaumokuʻi Cay Marine National Monument, about the need to protect these species.
It's important to realize that this is not just an albatross colony. Midway Atoll is home to the world's largest albatross colony. Mm-hmm. It is the single most important albatross colony for at least two species, the Laysan albatross and the black-footed albatross. Midway is a place where 3 million seabirds use 1,500 acres of land. This really is the most important piece of earth in the world for these albatross, and that's why protecting them there is so important.
Why do they return to that specific place?
So albatross have this amazing site fidelity, which means they want to come back to the same place every year. Wisdom, the world's oldest wild bird, she has been coming back to the exact same spot on Midway for the last 67 years. You know, we can find her nest every year because she is right there at the corner of the old Bravo Barracks. And the reason the albatross come to a place like Midway is it's not that close to where their food is. It's not super convenient. So they've evolved. They will fly 1,000 miles out into the ocean, eat, gather the food, fly 1,000 miles back, and feed their chick on Midway. Because on Midway, it has historically been a place where they could leave their chick alone. You know, they nest on the ground. They will sit on the egg until it hatches and sit on the chick until it gets to a certain size. But then you have these fluffy, flightless, defenseless chicks sitting on the ground, basically. And the albatross need a place free from predators, free from what you would find traditionally on mainland places: foxes, dogs, cats, all of those disturbances. So these small islands in the middle of the ocean, that's how they've evolved, is that they can leave their chicks safely behind, which is why seeing this unexpected predatory behavior in the mice has been so alarming to us.
When an environment ceases to be a pristine environment, the animals, the fauna that have that kind of vulnerable period in their lifespan, they're the first to go.
They are, and they don't have any place else to go. It's not like the albatross are going to, you know, they come back and they find that their nesting spot is no longer suitable.
Find another one.
Right? Yeah, there aren't other spots for them to go, and that's why it's so important to protect.
So that's that really incredible sort of, what would you call it, kind of a geolocating ability that these birds have is something we really barely understand.
Yeah, it's amazing, their navigating ability. And what's so incredible about albatross is that while the parents will invest an enormous amount in those long flights to get food and come back and feed their chick, once the chick has reached fledging age, or the age where it's going to fly off on its own, it does that independent of any guidance from its parents. These birds just somehow know, okay, I'm going to leave Midway now, and I know that I need to fly 500 miles to the northwest to find food. I'm going to land on the ocean.
It
I'm
just
gonna
knows.
There. And it just knows.
Your mom and dad
They're
don't
just these amazing creatures.
For...
Yeah, they don't. It doesn't follow its parents out there. It just knows where to go.
And yet other species of birds do have that kind of teaching behavior, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, you know, people have seen the videos of, you know, geese flying in formation, the big classic V formation.
Exactly.
And, you know, here on Oahu, we you know, you can see the white terns, you know, being fed in the trees, and there's a lot more interaction between mm-hmm. the parents and the chicks. Whereas for albatross, it really isn't. They're just this incredible species out there.
Well, to me, one of the arguments, you know, for preserving any species is if they contain behavioral mysteries like that, right?
Oh, yeah. And albatross are full of mysteries. Again, I mentioned Wisdom, 67 years old, and this year she's raising another chick. You know, that's incredible. There's so much we don't know about these birds. And the other thing that's really fascinating about albatross is that they are similar to us in many ways, that they are one of the top predators in the ocean. They go a long way out at sea. They forage on seafood just mm-hmm. like people do. They're impacted by pollution. They're impacted by climate change. We see in them a lot of it being mirrored back to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the threat to them?
So right now, the threat to the albatross is that they are being eaten by house mice. It's a completely unprecedented phenomenon. We had never observed it on Midway before. And in fact, nowhere in the world has scientists ever observed house mice attacking adult seabirds of this size.
Really?
And so back in 2015 is when we started to notice this. We saw albatross, volunteers who were out doing the annual bird count, trying to keep track of how many birds are on the island, started noticing these weird wounds on the birds. They were bloodied. We seemed like they had been in a fight, and we really didn't know what in the world was causing that. Were they being attacked by other birds? Had a raptor or something been blown in by a storm?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we set up night vision cameras in the colony on those birds that were showing up bloody in the morning that we saw it's actually house mice that are crawling onto the backs of these birds and literally eating them alive. And the albatross have, when they're sitting on their egg, they go into this trance-like state because they're so conditioned they got to protect the egg.
So they just stay there and
they would sit there in the videos, which are just horrific.
Oh, God.
You'd see them try and like roll over on their back, try and get the mouse off. They'd settle back down on the egg, and then the mouse climbs right back on. And it was just horrible to see.
This is an extraordinary behavioral shift, isn't it, for the house mouse?
It is, absolutely. It's an unprecedented behavioral shift. And one of the reasons that we have to deal with this problem is that we don't know what caused it. So as long as there are mice on Midway, there is still that ticking time bomb of, we don't know what caused that behavioral shift, but at any time, they could, on a massive scale, start attacking the birds.
Pretty strong argument for eradication.
We believe so. And again, the Fish and Wildlife Service and all of the partners in Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument, we don't take this effort lightly. This is the least bad choice that we have. You know, the mice, they're not villains.
You don't like
this.
The idea of eradicating.
No, this is a terrible thing to have to do,
yeah.
But this is the most important albatross colony for Laysan and black-footed albatross in the world. We have to help these species survive.
Just the very fact that the name that you have given to the oldest of these seabirds indicates sort of the value that you folks see in them.
Absolutely. And a place like Midway, where there is this huge colony, where we do have this long record of study, you know, wisdom is rewriting the book on how long birds can live in the wild. Nobody knew before wisdom that a 67-plus, perhaps, year-old bird would still be laying eggs, would still be raising chicks. This is writing that history book. This is writing that record book. So it's really important to save a place that produces so much knowledge for us.
And you're now in a public comment period for the eradication project?
Absolutely. So it's open now. It's open until April 20th. And, you know, we are interested in hearing from the public. You know, we're very cognizant that Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument is incredibly important to the people of Hawaii. Midway Atoll itself, it's the national memorial to the Battle of Midway. So even though it's a faraway place, there are so many people both here at home and across the globe who have a connection to Midway, even though it's remote and way out there, 1,200 miles northwest of Honolulu. So we want to hear from people because we certainly recognize that the actions we take there's a global interest in what we're doing.
Matt Brown is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Superintendent for Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument.
There are lots of do's and don'ts about owning a property that may be on the historic register. The Historic Hawaii Foundation, along with the Honolulu Chapter of American Institute of Architects, will focus on the greening of Hawaii's heritage homes. It's a series of workshops that launches next week, Monday.
This is a class that's called Greening Measures for Hawaii's Heritage Homes. It's a five-part class where people can come to one, some, or all of the classes. But they are focused on ways to add sustainability measures to older homes. So we've got a lot of 50 years and older residential homes throughout the islands. And a lot of them are very interested in bringing in energy efficiency, water efficiency, ways to reduce their carbon footprint or to just live lighter on the land. So we decided to bring those two things together and teach people how they can both preserve the characteristics of their historic home while adding these sustainability measures.
So if this was a homeowner, let's say, who wanted to put solar panels on their home, I mean, would this be the kind of thing you might want to go to?
That's a great example. So solar panels or other ways to conserve energy or to, again, reduce energy use can certainly be done in a way that is compatible with the historic character. But it has to be done thoughtfully, deliberately, and with an eye towards what's the right technology and where's the right location. So solar is one example. So are water catchment, energy efficient appliances, looking at ways to use landscaping and thoughtful gardening or water catchment techniques. We're looking at composting. We're looking at weatherizing, looking at just different ways to enhance the use of the natural climate.
So are there, let's say, like national standards when it comes to this whole sustainability greening of homes?
There certainly are. We have national standards for historic preservation generally, and then within that, there are more specific standards for historic buildings. And within that, there are guidelines on ways to integrate sustainability with your historic building. So we'll be building on all of those national standards and applying them to our local climate here.
So what's the first class?
The first class will be on Monday, April 9th. We are partnering with AIA Honolulu, so it'll be at the Center for Architecture on Fort Street. And the classes will be every other Monday, five classes total, so over 10 weeks.
And will we be emphasizing the latter half of the series?
So the first class is the big overview. What is preservation? What is sustainability? How do they work together? The second class is on water conservation. Third one is on energy. Then the May 21st will be windows. Everybody has a lot of interest in how to take care of their wooden windows especially. And then the final class is on creating a sustainable and culturally sensitive landscape.
And so these classes then aren't just for homeowners who, you know, might have a historic home, but they're for professionals as well?
Professionals as well. They are certified for continuing education credits by AIA for architects. We believe landscape architects and planners, engineers, contractors may also benefit. But they really are for the benefit of homeowners and tenants, people who are hands-on. So some do it yourself, some tips for hiring a professional, but really with this idea of being practical, pragmatic, and applying theory to practice.
And have things changed over the years, you know, as the technology has advanced with some of these issues?
I think there's been a greater awareness and a greater interest. People are looking for ways that they can be good stewards of not only historic and cultural resources, but of environmental and natural resources. So this pulls together that ethic, really. So the technology is always evolving, but there's a lot that was done originally, especially with siting, looking at the relationship to prevailing winds or using shade appropriately or looking at permaculture and permeable surfaces. So a lot of that has been part of Hawaii's design ethic for a good 100 years.
Now, I know with solar, though, with the advances with the technology, there are, you know, we have these huge panels now on a lot of buildings, but I know that they're experimenting with these smaller particles, if you will, that will actually go on a shingle. And I think at the University of Hawaii, there are some, you know, different types of technologies, that they, like a film they roll out. So are those kinds of things that are, you know, what's integrated in classes like this?
I think technology is one element of it, and we'll certainly bring in as much on that as we can. Another element of that is just reduction of energy consumption, so conservation as much as generation. So solar generates new power, but if you can reduce the amount of power you're using in the first place, that's also a viable technique. So looking at energy-efficient light bulbs, for example, or zoning your air conditioning so it doesn't run all the time. So there's ways that technology can help, but there's also just using planning and maintenance and thinking through the entire footprint as well.
Okay. Anything else you can share with us about the Historic Hawaii Foundation and maybe some of the goals going forward?
Well, Historic Hawaii Foundation helps people save historic places. So we do that in a variety of ways. These educational series are to empower people to make informed choices. And it's not only for listed historic homes, it's also for just older homes and people who may be interested in applying some of these techniques. We also work with other property owners, not just residential, but commercial and institutional, you know, museums and schools and churches and temples and property owners to help them understand what they have and how to best take care of it.
What's the biggest challenge facing the organization?
I think just the rapid rate of change puts a lot of pressure on some of our older areas. And I think there are ways to balance preservation with contemporary needs and being harmonious with who we are as a community now. But there's a lot of pressure, and trying to strike that balance and help people identify what's most important and how to take care of it is a constant challenge.
And you folks have been, I think, working with the various agencies that look at historic structures and cultural resources to be able to identify maybe the best examples of, let's say, a certain type of building or period, because a lot of homes in Hawaii are historic if you go by the, you know, the 50-year, you know, age threshold. And but you're doing more of that, right, identifying maybe the most threatened?
We have a couple of programs to draw attention, and one that has been very popular over the years has been our Most Endangered Historic Places program. There's a section at historichawaii.org that is organized by island, and it highlights what are some of the endangered, threatened historic places that really do need attention or conservation or some kind of stewardship to ensure that they remain part of our legacy going forward. So that's on the kind of take action now side. And then we also have an annual awards program that really highlights preservation achievements. There are some wonderful people and groups that are working really hard to save historic places, and it's great to be able to draw attention to some of those and tell their stories and what they've done to be able to perpetuate and preserve some very important historic sites. So our annual awards program happens in May.
All right. So lots of different fronts that you're tackling, just to kind of preserve the history and have these structures available so that we can all enjoy them going forward.
And I would encourage everyone to enjoy them going forward. You know, when you go to your favorite places, think about the people who have come before and the people who will be coming after, and the role that we have to bridge those generations. It's pretty exciting.
That was Kirsten Faulkner of Historic Hawaii Foundation talking about an upcoming series of classes that kicks off next week, Monday. Again, those workshops open to interested homeowners as well as professionals. You can find out details on our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And earlier this week on the show, we talked about toxoplasmosis, and listeners had a great deal to say about the topic. Patrick from Honolulu wrote, "Once we resolve to care for cats the way we do dogs and other domestic animals, by requiring them to be contained and ensuring they are removed from sensitive areas that affect our native wildlife, we can be good neighbors and give due care to both native and introduced animals."
Hi, my name is Janice. I'm calling from Kailua, Kona. I think that you can't separate values between being humane and saving other animals. I think it's important that we're humane to cats. Cats do not just move along. If there's no food, they starve. So it's very important to people who care about all animals, but I also feel that there are a lot of things that are damaging the populations of near shore species and native plants, and they are created by humans, not by cats. Thank you.
We thank you for your thoughts. You can always tell us what's on your mind by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or emailing us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Time now to talk politics on The Conversation. Capitol watchers have been talking about what seems like more bills getting gutted and replaced during this legislative session. That is the subject of today's reality check with Chad Blair from Honolulu Civil Beat. Morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, we're not the only ones that are noticing all these gut and replace bills.
Yeah, you and I were emailing yesterday about this. I mean, this is not unheard of. It happens every session, but particularly at the end of this session, we've only got a month left, barely a month, and particularly in Donovan Dela Cruz's Ways and Means Committee, quite a lot of bills have been gutted and replaced at the last minute. What does that mean? That means taking a bill that's already died, completely getting rid of all the language that is in there, and putting in something entirely new, as long as it's related to the subject matter of the bill. There's another phenomenon known as Frankenstein bills, which you can imagine what that is, but that's basically taking language from bills that have already died and attaching them to ones that are still existing, even though they may be fairly radical. It's happened quite a lot. Is this a good thing? You know, people that support it argue, look, we can keep on talking about this issue, keep the discussion going. But other people say you're kind of keeping the public out of the loop. You're not giving them a whole lot of time to jump in and testify.
That's right, because there's not much lead time. And I know I came across it when I was trying to track the vacation rental bill,
right,
and was asking, well, what about the deadline? And what about the deadline? They said, oh, well, you know, we just plan to gut and replace. And it was just like, okay, so you're so the House is really far from the Senate on this issue of vacation rentals.
So. Right. And here's what happens with that. We're going to go into conference committee the last 2 weeks of April, and that's where the House and Senate have to hash out their differences. And in this case, you've got a bill that's already died in one chamber, been revived in another, and now they've got to work this out. And here's the problem for us, the public, as well as the media. There's no hearings. There's no public testimony. We don't get to see what happens. It's all behind closed doors. They then announce the results later. Either they're going to kill the bill or they're going to pass it. So that's very frustrating. And frankly, I think a public disservice.
Right. And I know your article today talks about, I think, the hemp bill that sort of like disappeared.
Yeah, that's just one example. This is a bill that would have funded a pilot program for industrial hemp. That's something we've been talking about for a long time. Instead, it has now something to do with East Maui water systems. Where's the tie-in there? Well, they both have something to do with agriculture, but it's a bit of a stretch to leap from hemp to streams in East Maui, but that's exactly the kind of thing that happens all the time. And you wonder whether that builds some resentment. Hey, you took my bill and you made it into this. What, you want me to support it now? I mean, those kind of discussions do go on.
Right. It's all the horse trading and the politics that goes on behind closed doors that we don't get to see.
Exactly. Frustrating.
Yes. Very frustrating. All right. Well, thanks so much, Chad. We'll be watching those Frankenstein bills.
Thanks, right. Catherine.
Okay. That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's reality check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, supporting Hawaii's educators with Smarty Ants, a foundational reading approach for teaching students to read in pre-K through second grade. Achieve3000.com.
Justice Joseph Williams of the New Zealand Court of Appeal is of Maori descent, and he has watched down through the years as his native culture has gained recognition in government and judicial circles. He's the first person of Maori descent and the first who speaks his native tongue appointed to one of his nation's highest courts. He's in Hawaii this week as the international jurist in residence at the UH Law School, and we spoke about similarities between Maori history and that of the Hawaiian people.
Well, I suppose the first point is that they're essentially the same indigenous cultures. We're the southernmost Polynesians, and native Hawaiians are the northernmost Polynesians.
Mm-hmm.
I think Native Hawaiians arrived in these islands maybe 500, 700 years before we, the last of the Polynesians to populate a populatable island, arrived in Aotearoa, which is probably about 1000 AD, maybe 1100 AD.
Mm-hmm.
Same basic values, the same basic language, really. I think Hawaiian and Māori are as similar as Italian and Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So almost
linguistic roots.
Almost mutually intelligible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good launching point. We really are, in an ancient way, the same people. The second point is we're colonized at the same time. In fact, Cook is effectively the first white guy to turn up to Aotearoa, to New Zealand, and the first white guy to turn up to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Our treaty of cession, as it's called in English, the Treaty of Waitangi, was signed in 1840 at the time of the Mahele, mm-hmm, here. And that following 60 years in Hawaii that led to the overthrow of the kingdom in the 1890s is a time of colonial usurpation in Aotearoa by different means. We didn't have a single, prior to white contact, we didn't have a single king, a single administration. We had valley by valley tribal systems of control and government, and still do. So that's a little different. We are, Māori are by nature more atomized.
Atomized, what is that?
In the sense that every valley has its own king.
I see, yeah.
The tribes are defiantly independent of one of the other,
mm-hmm,
and engage occasionally still, and certainly historically, in highly competitive behavior between each other, mm-hmm, although they are closely related.
Mm-hmm.
So colonization's impacts were different in the detail. In this kind of surface historical narrative, there's a difference, but in the underlying causes and effects, almost identical. So in Hawaii, you've got 1.2 million people living in the state, something like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
About 20% Native Hawaiian.
Give or take.
Yeah. So 16% Māori in a country of 4.5 million, mm-hmm, about 650,000 people. And, of course, that period from 1840 through to, I guess, the 1920s or 30s, the period of the arrival and ultimate usurpation of British rule, the ultimate usurpation of tribal rule by British rule, introduced the same sorts of issues. The arrival of Christianity, technology, the stresses of modernity. That is, you know, it wasn't all, you know, bad white guys turn up and beat up on.
It's never
good,
that simple.
Good brown guys. It was the brown guys quite liked a bit of what the white guys were bringing, and so the chiefs were trying to lead their way through this period of engaging with modernity.
Mm-hmm.
How they would engage, some of their experiments were a terrible failure, some of their experiments were relatively successful. And that's exactly the same story as you see in Hawaii.
It's a story of very different value systems being imposed on one another, mm-hmm, or, you know, having to sort of coexist,
mm-hmm,
and the inevitable frictions that result, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Well, precisely, a vehemently individualist system by the 1850s,
mm-hmm,
running headlong into a vehemently collectivist system.
Mm-hmm.
Again, by the second half of the 19th century, a vehemently empiricist system running headlong into a vehemently spiritual system.
Empiricist in what sense?
Well, you know, science was the ruler in the British Empire of the 20th century. Still very Christian, of course, but, you know, this is post-Enlightenment where
rationality rules.
That's right. Rationality is the rule, yeah.
And that sort of elbows out spiritual values.
Well, a system that sees the land as an ancestor and the local rivers as ancestors, the connection between people and environment, as a blood connection, between people and trees, between people and animals as essentially blood connections, not as some sort of romantic ideal, not as some sort of Garden of Eden thing, but actually.
That's a stretch for a Western rationalist.
It sure is. It sure is. And, of course, missionaries came wanting to disabuse this people of those ideas because they were errant nonsense. Mm-hmm. So they genuinely believed that this would improve the lot of these people as they were drawn out of darkness into the light of salvation through redemption with the Lord Jesus Christ. But of course, in the process, the missionaries along with the other settlers were massively enriched because they got the land.
Well, and there's a sense throughout the whole missionary experience that pagan or heathen beliefs were satanic, were evil, were to be purged from people's belief systems, right?
Absolutely. And the version of Protestantism that came to New Zealand was a fundamentalist version of Protestantism.
Especially strict.
Quite strict, yeah, quite strict.
The Calvinist strain.
Quite Calvinist, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So low church Anglican. So much like, I think, to some extent, what was received here in Hawaii. So,
But distrustful of things like dancing, singing, voluble expressions of joy and emotion, yeah?
Absolutely. And quite afraid of that. Māori exuberant expression was frowned upon. In fact, it was scary because these Māoris were heavily armed, much more heavily armed than the settlers were, mm-hmm. with British technology.
So just seeing the welcoming ceremony is enough to put fear in you if you're.
I know for coming from that's the, right for people who aren't used to it. It is a very strange way to say hi, welcome into my home.
Yeah, with a smack on the rear. Right?
That's right, and a very scary grimace.
Yeah.
and yelling.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit bizarre if you're not used to it.
Well, it's really something to see, but it's also kind of symbolic of the kind of culture clash that is involved here.
Yeah, that's right. So that was all frowned upon, and ultimately, just as here, the language itself was frowned upon. The Polynesians in the south, just as those in the north, had to become dusky-skinned, English-speaking, individualist, Calvinist, doer versions of what was taking place, what was either on the east coast of the U.S. or in Britain. It didn't matter. It's the same thing.
Are you seeing a movement toward harmony in your country and here?
I'm no expert on here at all, so I'd better not venture an opinion on that, but I'm hopeful about that. I am, I think, finally seeing some sort of peace being made in Aotearoa between the indigenous people and the settlers after a generation of a treaty settlement process aimed at reparations and restoration, aimed at putting the colonial period on trial and being honest about that, aimed at reconstructing the tribes that were circumvented because they were a wall against colonization, and of course they were militarily powerful. We are seeing the country coming through the tunnel to the light at the other end. I'm not saying it's the beautiful sunny uplands at all. Only time will tell us whether this generational experiment has produced the sort of peace we need. But what I can say is that the attempt is genuine and that the people engaged in it on both sides appear to be very hopeful that this might work.
Can't really ask for much more than that.
That's right. Yeah.
Justice Joseph Williams of the New Zealand Court of Appeal is in Hawaii this week as the International Jurist in Residence at the UH Law School. He's the first person of Maori descent and the first who speaks his native tongue appointed to one of his nation's highest courts. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. We'll take you back to Pledge Central with Bill Dorman.